seriously, we could be here a long time. I get in trouble when I extemporize. So we're going to sing one song tonight, and we're going to sing the same song at the close. Turn to number 28. We're talking about the created universe and the created earth. We're going to sing How Great Thou Art. We're going to sing verses 2, 3, and 4 now, and then we're going to save the first verse to the end of the service. All right? So verses 2, 3, and 4 right now. And we're not going to receive an offering this evening. The plates are here. If you didn't get your offering in the plate this morning, put it in before you leave. But we won't pass the plates. We're going to sing this. We're going to pray. And I'm going to go to the presentation. All right? number 28. Let's stand together as we sing verses 2, 3, and 4. How great thou art. Be seated. All right, this will take me just a second to get it going here because I didn't want to leave the song from behind the screen. There we go. And I was worried about the PowerPoint. I'll be doing this presentation from down here. And another thing that makes it dangerous for the timing is that I'll have my back to the clock. Yeah. No, don't.
Yeah, you need an outline. David's got the outlines for anybody who didn't get one and needs one. What's this? Just saw it laying there. Now, I've covered this material sort of in the past. And when I did my initial research on the subject, I did it in the mid-1990s. And so I thought I'd better do at least a little additional reading for some more recent findings in the field. And I consulted three different books that are more recent. This one, Starlight and Time, by astrophysicist Russell Humphreys. The math in that's kind of challenging. This one, On the Global Flood, by Dr. John D. Morris. And this one, On the Young Earth, also by Dr. John D. Morris. This one, On the Young Earth, actually came with a CD with two PowerPoint presentations on it. One of them had 101 slides. The other one had 45, so you've got a bunch of slides. All right? I have borrowed from that to put this together because I thought some of these photographs and diagrams would be helpful. I did not create the slide. I created the first one. The only one of the slideshow that I actually created is that one, the title of my message, all right? The rest of those, the rest of these have come from, hang on, let me get my mouse working. I am ignoring the clock at the bottom of the screen. It's off. No, it's actually correct, all right. Thanks for pointing that out, buddy. All right, yeah. I never did figure out how to do this full screen share, so there's got to be a way. I said, I'm sure there is, and about six people in the congregation can show me how to do it, but I'm not going to bother. All right. Anyway, I did want to give credit to the Creation Research Institute for Creation Research for having created the slides that I'll be using in this presentation. All right. Let's start with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight and to consider this aspect of a defense of the Christian faith. We are often mocked for our confidence in the scriptural account of creation, and there are many who would who assume that that is a silly and unsupportable view. And Lord, we need to be prepared to answer the accusations and the charges. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to be able to have our confidence bolstered and edified, strengthened through our study this evening. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, as I did my research on this, I ended up splitting what I'd done before into two different messages. I'll be dealing with the second part of it next week, Lord willing. This one, I'm kind of going on defense, responding to the supposed evidence of an old earth. That is, what about all the evidence that the earth has to be billions of years old? And we'll talk about what those evidences are. How do we answer that? Do we have a way to answer that? Or are we just going to, you know, fold our tents and say, okay, I give up. We'll just treat Genesis 1 through 11 as if it's mythological and in some way instructive, but not real history. I'm not prepared to do that. I don't think that's the right approach at all. And then there are, next week, what I'm going to do is focus on, we'll kind of go on offense, and we'll focus on the evidences for a young earth that the evolutionary scientists ignore, that actually supports the young earth. Tonight we're trying to say, here's a way to understand their evidence that doesn't conflict with scripture, and next week we'll say, here's some things they won't talk about because their model can't stand as a result of some of the evidences we'll look at next week. And I don't have a slideshow for that one, all right? So I'm just going to be dealing with this tonight, and my wife will tell you that I've been nervous enough about this. I've been over here for the last 3 days practicing, and it gets longer every time. All right, so I'll try to stick to the script. My first and last points in the outline that you have, Roman numeral 1 and Roman numeral 4, are identical, with a slight difference at the very end. First of all is the introduction. Opposing interpretations of the same data. Opposing interpretations of the same data. That's point number 1 and point number 4. Because everybody looks at the same data and draws different conclusions. Here's a slide that helps explain that. If you start with an assumption of naturalism, You look at the data. What is the data? The fossils are the ones that are shown in the picture there. Whatever the data may be, everybody's got the same information available to them. And whatever interpretation you're going to have of your view of origins, we're all looking at the same data. If you start with an assumption of naturalism, there is no God and everything happened on its own, you look at that data and you interpret, well, God couldn't have been involved because there is no God, therefore it had to have happened gradually on its own, and it takes a long, long time for that to, it would have to take a long time for that to have occurred, therefore you come up with an evolutionary theory that requires billions of years in age. If you start, on the other hand, with an assumption that the biblical history is accurate, that Genesis tells us what really happened because God the Creator was the one who was there and the one who did it, we look at the same data and we can draw a different conclusion, that God created and that the data supports actually a young earth. Everybody's looking at the same information. It's not competing boxes of clues, all right? Everybody's got the same information, and it's just a matter of differing interpretations of the same data. Now, I would say, when we say a young earth, I'm talking about an earth that was created 6,000 to 10,000 years ago. Where do we get those times? Why would we say 6,000 to 10,000 years? If you look at the biblical genealogies, they're kind of disjointed. They appear in different places in the Old Testament record. But there are genealogies that connect from Adam all the way up to Christ that tell you the age of each progenitor when the next son in line was born. And if you add all those up, Archbishop Usher did this back in the, I don't remember which century, the 14th century, whenever it was, Archbishop Usher is credited with having done the math on that. And he calculated that God created the earth in about 4004 BC. So that'd be about 6,025 years ago from right now, if you add the genealogies up. And if you assume there are no gaps in any of the genealogies, that would give us 6,000 years. Many will say 10,000 years, use that as the figure. Where are they just giving it a little wiggle room? That's not the point. What the 10,000-year figure actually comes from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The Greek translation actually gives longer periods, older ages for the progenitor before the next generation was born, and inserts a few names into the genealogies that aren't found in the Hebrew text. And if you take the Septuagint's dates and add those up the same way, you get creation happening about 4,000 years earlier, about 8,000 BC. And so you get a 10,000-year figure. And so we'll go with a 6,000 to 10,000-year range. I happen to think that there's no reason to accept the Septuagint's records and that the Hebrew record is authoritative. And so I happen to be comfortable with the 6,000-year difference. You understand that 6,000 to 10,000 years, in this conversation, the difference between the two is immaterial. It's absolutely insignificant. Because the extra 4,000 years does not give evolution time to happen. Okay? It makes absolutely no difference to this conversation. And so you will hear a young earth creationist talk about 6,000 years, or some of them say 10,000 years. That's the reason for the difference in times. Okay? I thought I'd explain that. That's the difference between, the basic difference is, do we need billions of years or do we need a few thousand years for the age of the earth? Evolution assumes that all life began from a single organism, a common ancestor. That's letter A in your outline under number one. Evolution assumes all life developed from a common ancestor, started out with single-celled organisms somehow managing to come alive in the primordial ooze, and beginning to branch off into other things by growing new body parts and introducing new genetic data from sources yet to be discovered. They use the twin mechanisms of mutation and natural selection to produce new basic categories out of the old, so that all life is interrelated, all life on Earth is assumed to be interrelated. Now, nothing has ever been observed to actually do that. No scientist has ever observed that happening. In the wild. And they can't make it happen in a laboratory. And since it can't be observed and can't be produced in a laboratory, the assumption then is that it happens so slowly, we just can't see it. And Ken Ham has commented, I think accurately, that if something is happening so slowly you can't see it, what is there to prove that isn't actually happening? But they're assuming it's happening so slowly we can't see it, therefore it has to have had a lot of time. And so the passing of immense amounts of time becomes the catch-all answer for how this is even conceivable. George Wald, W-A-L-D, is a leading evolutionary spokesman. In an essay he wrote called The Origin of Life, it's found in the Physics and Chemistry of Life on page 12, he said this, "Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles." Now, I don't know about you, but that strikes me as being excessively optimistic. Okay? If you just wait long enough, it's going to happen. Evolution, then, as Dr. Morris has put it, he says, evolution has become something of a rug under which is swept all of the theory's problems, including the seeming design of all things in the universe, particularly life, and the lack of transitional forms, which I'll say more about in a moment. Creation, letter B, says that God created everything in six solar days. You can put 24-hour days, if you want, in there with the quotes, or solar days. This graphic from the Christian Institute of Creation Research says, talks about the Hebrew word yom, meaning day, and it refers to a very, very specifically to a 24-hour day. To call it a 24-hour day is something of an anachronism. They weren't using modern timepieces or modern calculations of time when the scriptures were written, and so I prefer just to say a solar day. What constitutes a day in Genesis? And I'll say more about this when we get to the actual text of Genesis. I'll develop this. But a day is a period of dark and a period of light. It's one day. I mean, it's a pretty commonplace expression, and that's what they're talking about. Creation says that God made everything in six literal solar days. There are those who have proposed a theory that's called the day-age theory, and again, I'll deal with this when we study Genesis, that says that each of those days of creation were eons long to allow for evolution to occur in periodic stages, that day-age theory. The biggest problem with that is mentioned here, too. There's a contradiction between Genesis and the geological ages. Evolution occurs, the geological ages of evolution require a different order of presentation, a different order of production, if you will, than what the Bible presents. Evolution assumes that matter existed in the beginning. The Bible says it was created by God in the beginning. Evolution assumes that everything was land first, and then the waters were produced gradually through volcanic action. The oceans were first on the surface before the dry land, according to Scripture, and so on down there. The order doesn't work. The order required by evolution is not the order presented in Scripture, so you can't make them coincide. They don't work together. Now, with that said, by way of introduction, so we understand what that we're basically talking about opposing interpretations of the same data. There are some specific challenges to a young Earth model that need to be considered, and I'm going to start with one that is the one that's actually the most difficult, because a definitive alternative explanation is impossible to prove and remains still theoretical. This is the challenge of distant stars. That's number two, Roman numeral two, the challenge of distant stars. The problem of distant starlight. We are receiving, the Earth revolves around a star called Sol, which is in one, it's kind of outside edge arm of the great spiral galaxy called the Milky Way. The closest star to our sun has been identified as a star called Alpha Centauri. Anybody, how far away is it? You remember? It's 4 light years. Now, a light year is not a measurement of time. It's a measurement of distance. Light travels 186,000 miles in a second. It goes quite a distance in a year, right? And so the closest star to our sun is 4 light years away. It takes, so if Alpha Centauri were to blow up tonight, it would take 4 years before we'd know, because we wouldn't be able to see the light from that until that time. Right, that's the closest star to our sun. And various stars have been measured at various distances. I mean, the Milky Way itself is vast, and then there are other galaxies scattered throughout the universe that are far, far away. And so how far away is the most distant star? I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. But let's say a million light years, because that's a conservative estimate, because I know they're talking about multiple millions of light years away. If the Earth has only been here for 6,000 years, We ought to be able to see the light from stars that are only 6,000 light years away or closer. Every night there ought to be new lights coming on as the sky gets populated with new stars as that light arrives from more distant stars. But that's not what's happening. We go outside and we look at a night sky that's got stars all over the place, and many of those stars are already millions of light years away. How can we see the light from a star that far away when the Earth's only been here for 6,000 years? How do we answer that charge? Most evolutionists consider that argument absolutely fatal to the young Earth theory. And in fact, many biblical scholars agree that it's fatal to a young Earth, and that's part of a problem, all right? Part of the answer is that what we've got here is the appearance of age. A functionally mature system must have the appearance of age. In any situation, a functionally mature system must have the appearance of age. Letter A. Genesis tells us that God created the night, the stars, in order to give light and in the night sky for signs and for seasons. That requires that their light would be visible here from the moment of creation, even if they're quite distant. In fact, Genesis says that God created light before he created the stars, including the sun, to be sources of light for the universe. He created the light first. Then he placed it within those light bearers and made them the light bearers for the sake of the earth. Now, a God who can create light to be immediately visible on earth would have no problem creating a system that's already functional and mature. That is, if he said, okay, I'm going to create the stars to be sources of that light was already there and in motion. He just created the system. And so that's a part of the answer, the appearance of age. He does that with everything. I mean, when he created trees and fruit trees, they were already bearing fruit on the first day. Don't you ever plant a fruit tree? It takes a while for it to grow and become mature enough to start producing fruit. And on the day he created the trees, they were already bearing fruit. And you understand that for them to be standing there and bearing fruit, they had to have rings. And you say, well, a tree, if you cut it down, has rings. You can count how old the tree is by the number of rings. But on the very day they were created, they had to have rings because those rings had to be there to produce, to provide the nutrients for the plant to be able to produce the fruit, as well as the structural stability for the thing to stand there and not just be a reed, all right, for it to actually be a tree. I mean, how old did Adam look 5 minutes after he was created? Okay, he didn't look like a five-minute-old newborn, okay, much less a five-minute-old fetus. He was created as a functional adult. I would guess he looked to be in his mid-30s, in the prime of life. But he was just made a few minutes ago. To be a functional adult, he had to have the appearance of age. Any functionally mature system has to have the appearance of age. How long does it take for topsoil to be made from the detritus that falls off of trees? It takes a while for it to break down and turn into topsoil. But the trees had to be able to grow in soil. That soil had to already be there. How old was the soil? A few minutes. Okay? Because God made it, so it was a functionally mature system. So this is a part of the answer. But it's only a part of the answer. And here's why. And here's where the challenge will come in. An astrophysicist or an astronomer watching the night sky witnesses a star a million light years away go supernova, blows up. Well, the light from that supernova has taken, theoretically, 100 million years to get here, if it's 100 million light years away. You say, well, God created it with the appearance of age. Are we now witnessing the destruction of a star that never actually existed? That's the question that's asked, all right? Are you trying to tell me then that God created a false history in the night sky so that we have just a light show of stars that blow up even though they're all this distance away and that light couldn't possibly have gotten here if the Earth is only 6,000 years old and that happened a million light years from here? That's why the appearance of age is only a part of the answer. And here's where Dr. Russell Humphreys, the astrophysicist, in his book, Starlight and Time, can be helpful. But as I said, the math is kind of challenging. His basic premise, and I'm not going to pretend to understand all of it, basically what he claims that he has shown, he takes Einstein's theory of relativity, and if, here's what he supposes. If the Earth and sun, our solar system, is in fact at roughly the center of the universe, as Scripture implies, since God created the rest of the universe for our sakes. If we are roughly at the center of the universe, and if the universe is expanding outward from our place in it at approximately the same pace in every direction as astrophysicists agree is happening, everything's moving away from us at the same pace, all right? If that is in fact the case, Einstein's theory of relativity actually predicts that light from anywhere in the known universe would reach this point in 2 days from the date of its beginning, all right? That's another part of the answer. It's theoretical. My point is not that we have the answer to this question or to this problem, but that we must not cave in and fold our tents and admit defeat in that argument. This is a copy of the cover of the book, Starlight and Time by Dr. Russell Humphreys. Forwards by Ken Ham, but it's, I think it was published by Creation Research Institute. Right? Moving on. Another supposed difficulty for the young Earth view is the geological ages, the challenge of geology. The challenge of geology. Now, if the flood actually laid down the rock layers, the sedimentary layers that are found all over the Earth, if the flood actually laid them down, there were no geological ages because it all happened in a single year. If that were the case, if there were in fact a flood that laid down all those rock layers in a single year, what would we expect to find? If someone heard that theory and said, okay, I'm going to go looking over the Earth and see if I could prove that that actually happened, what would that model predict? Well, the flood model predicts these five things that you would find, among other things, but five important things geologically. You would find evidence of catastrophic deposition of rock layers. You would find evidence of regional stratigraphy, that is, not just localized strata, stacks of rock layers like under the neighbor's pond, but region-wide, large, even hemispherical deposits of rock layers. You would find sediments that deformed before hardening if they were all deposited in a single year. They haven't had time to harden, and they deformed when other things happened to cause them to shift position and deform. You would find evidence of rapid canyon erosion, and you would find dating results that are not consistent. Now, let me tell you, I should have told you this before I started on this slide. These are points A through E in the outline. So I'm going to deal with each of these as we go. And I'll come back to each of them as we go. I'm going to spend most of the time on letter A, catastrophic deposition of rock layers. But this is A through E in the outline under Roman numeral 3. Catastrophic deposition of rock layers. Now, when we start talking about catastrophic natural phenomena, events, certain things come to mind, right? What are some things you think of? Hurricanes, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes. The one that is actually considered the most catastrophic of phenomena that is witnessed in the Earth today is a tsunami. A tsunami. According to a National Geographic Explorer program that aired in May of 1998, that's been a while, Dr. Walter Dudley of the University of Hawaii said the tsunami is, quote, the most catastrophic of all phenomena, end quote. He stated that a tsunami in the 1940s was recorded at a height of 56 feet. 56 feet. So if you're following the outline, number one, a tsunami, the most powerful change agent observable today, the highest recorded was 56 feet high in the 1940s. However, he also stated that there is evidence in the geological record that in prehistoric times, now you understand what he means by prehistoric times? Prehistoric means before written history. The prehistoric era, by any anthropological measure, the prehistoric era is believed to have begun at about 2500 BC. Anything prior to that? Lo and behold, that's about the time of the flood. There's no written evidence of human civilization prior to that. And it coincides with the date of the flood. And so when anybody talks about something being prehistoric, we tend to think of it in dinosaurs and such, but because that thanks to the Flintstones we grew up watching, right? okay? But that which is prehistoric is that which predates written history. And written history began in about 2500 BC. According to them, we actually have records that go back from that before that because of the scriptures. But they assume everything prior to 2500 BC is prehistoric. And what he says is during prehistoric times, there's evidence that there were there were tsunamis upward of 1,000 feet high. Sounds like a global flood to me. And the flood would actually predict heights exceeding 1,000 feet. It's almost impossible to imagine what a tsunami of that size, that height, would, what devastation it would wreak. Another observable force for change in a natural phenomena for change are called turbidites. A turbidite, number two, is an underwater mudslide that deposits layers of sediment in the trench below. This is a diagram of a turbidite that occurred off the northern coast of Canada in 1927. If you look at this screen, think of the top line here as the surface of the ocean. You have here the continental shelf. There was an earthquake that caused a whole bunch of stacked sediment here slide down here into this trench and lay down deposits of rock layers at the bottom of the trench in the oceanic abyss. These dots here represent transatlantic telephone cables that had been laid prior to that in the early 1900s. Because then that mudslide occurred, it started snapping telephone lines. And at the rate and distance which those telephone lines were snapped, they were able to determine how fast the mudslide moved and how widespread the turbidite was. And they concluded that this turbidite moved at a speed of 60 miles an hour. It traveled a distance of 430 miles, and it covered an area of 40,000 square miles. Buried it to a depth of 2 to 3 feet in layers of sediment underwater. Now a flood, the worldwide flood model would predict that we would see evidence of things like this all over the place. Interestingly enough, recent geological inquiry has determined that 1/3 to 1/2 of all sedimentary rock found on the continents worldwide are in fact turbidites. Underwater mudslides that left those deposits. Now, turbidity flows happen today, and one turbidite doesn't prove anything, but the flood's prediction of a world full of turbidites has, in fact, been verified. There are turbidites all over the place. One of the most vivid examples of rock layers laid down by turbidite action is the Grand Canyon. So these turbidites, little letter A under the outline, they're found worldwide as only the flood model predicts. And they're found at all elevations, which no evolutionary model can explain, how you could have a turbidite at the top of a mountain range. And it includes many rock layers found at the Grand Canyon. As you see those rock layers there and those beautiful parallel horizontal layers, various thickness. Here's another photo from the Grand Canyon. Showing some of those turbidite rock layers. Here's another photo. Oh wait, that's not the Grand Canyon, is it? Looks like it, but it's Mount St. Helens. How many of you remember Mount St. Helens when it blew up? May 1980. All right, a lot of us remember that. Some of you are too young, but that, anyway. Oh brother. Sorry. All right. These rock layers were laid down in hours or days. And it gives us an interesting working laboratory to see how this might function. You've got them now, similar rock formations found there. Here's another picture from Mount St. Helens. A very close shot of very fine layers. And here's another shot from Mount St. Helens. It's kind of hard to tell the shots from Mount St. Helens from the shots from the Grand Canyon. When you're looking just at the rock layers. And so turbidites are illustrated, little letter B, by the Grand Canyon and by Mount St. Helens. And the fact that the latter were deposited in hours or days, not eons, I think is highly instructive. Now, with all of this talk about the geology and the laying down of the rock layers, the main issue in dealing with this whole question is fossils. When did the fossils die? Because fossils are dead things, right? People talk about, well, they found a living fossil. That's an oxymoron. There's no such thing. It's a contradiction. A fossil is, by definition, something dead. Ken Ham, you've heard what he said about what the flood predicts. If the flood really occurred, what you would expect to find are millions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. And if you go out and look around, what you actually find are millions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. It's exactly what the flood would have predicted. And so I've provided number three is fossils, millions of his quote, millions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. Now, Ham's little statement there actually understates the number. The estimates for the total number of fossils worldwide is in the trillions. And a trillion is a million million. So there's a lot of fossils. But that, too, is predicted by the flood model. You have a year-long, mountain-covering, worldwide flood. It would have reshaped the Earth's surface, and it would have left vast deposits, letter A in the outline. The flood would have left vast deposits of plants and animals quickly buried in sediment, which turned to stone. Now, if the flood made the rocks and fossils, there were no geological ages. This is a diagram that's a cutaway of a portion of the Grand Canyon, showing rock layers of the Grand Canyon and the river valley down here, and some of the stone layers underneath here, and the various layers and as they've been labeled going up there. I know you can't read any of that stuff. All right. If the flood made the rocks and the fossils, then there aren't any geological ages, and we don't have to worry about that. Fossil record actually supports the flood model in part because, letter B, the fossils show evidence of rapid catastrophic deposition. They were deposited rapidly because of a catastrophe. They weren't deposited gradually. You know, if a fish dies in your pond, it's not going to turn into a fossil. What's going to happen to it? It's going to float to the surface or it's going to sink to the bottom, and it's going to either simply decompose by bacterial action or a scavenger is going to get it. And it's going to get destroyed and eaten that way. It's going to break down and turn into muck. It's not going to turn into a fossil. It has to be buried quickly in the right conditions for it to ever become a fossil. Here's a picture of a clam. This clam is a fossil. This one is one of myriads of clam fossils discovered in an outcrop in Texas. Both sides are completely tightly shut. Now, a living clam can burrow into the ground. It can do all sorts of things that are pretty remarkable. But when it's disturbed, it shuts itself up tightly. It clams up for protection. This particular clam is one of myriads with which it was buried there at that outcrop in Texas. It was deposited rapidly, and it shut itself up to protect itself, buried so rapidly it could not burrow out, and it never moved once it was buried. Neither did any of the others. There's no evidence of their movement. They just got buried and stayed, stuck right there. That's not what happens to clams in the normal course of events. We find fish fossilized, precisely preserved. We find these by the trillions. And again, but a fish doesn't die that way. It's destroyed by scavengers. We find fish buried in schools. Fish don't die that way either. I like this picture. This one was buried so quickly it didn't have time to finish swallowing its lunch. Both the fish and the fish it's swallowing, the fish it's eating, were fossilized right there in mid-gulp. It didn't even get it all the way into its mouth. That's fast. That's rapid deposition, okay? And in great detail. Now, I'm sure you've heard, if you've ever visited a cavern or something, and they talk about stalagmites and stalactites in the caves, how they take millions of years to form. Here's a stalagmite that formed so rapidly that a bat that perched on the side of it for a moment was encased in a stone and didn't escape and became a part of the fossil itself. There are others that show evidence of rapid formation. Apparently, I mean, some stalagmites and stalactites are forming very slowly today, and so they're assuming it's always been that way. But there have been times when they've been formed much more rapidly. And we don't have to assume millions of years of age because of the existence of stalagmites and stalactites, just because they're growing at slow rates today. Now, here's a slide that has way too much information on it. Okay, but I want to just see the picture. What you've got, let me explain what you have here, and I'm not going to talk you through all of it. On the left-hand column, going from the bottom to the top, those are the supposed geological ages. In the sequence, with the bottom being the most ancient and the top one being the most recent, the current age, if you will. That which is in the middle, what you've got in the middle, those pictures of those animals, that's supposed to depict the animals that are assumed to be predominant in each of the successive geological evolutionary ages. The column on the right, though, is the actual record of what the fossils show in the successive evolutionary age, in the various rocks supposed to have come from those eras. They do not show the evolutionary progress from simple to complex that is predicted by the evolutionists. They start out as complex marine. See those at the bottom of the list there? They're on the bottom of the right-hand column. Those are not simple organisms. Those are complex living organisms. They just happen to live at the bottom of the sea. And they happen to be not very mobile because they're shellfish. But as you go up, there's not much change in the nature of the creatures that are found in the fossil record. Here's an interesting fact. The real fossil record. 95% of all fossils are marine invertebrates, primarily shellfish. 95% of all the fossils in the world are marine invertebrates. Of the 5% that remain, 95% of those are plants. Of what's left, 95% of those are fish. Most of the rest are insects, and much less than 1% are land vertebrates. And those land vertebrate fossils usually consist of less than one bone. Now let me put quantities to the percentages, just by giving you some numbers. And you got to get with big numbers or none of this stuff makes sense. So if you start with 1 million random fossils and apply these percentages, with 1 million random fossils, 950,000 of them are going to be marine invertebrates, leaving with only 50,000 more to work with, mostly shellfish. Of the 50,000 that you have left, 47,500 of those are plants, leaving you with only 2,500 to work with. Of the 2,500 left, 2,375 of those are fish, leaving you just 125 left. And of the 125 left, at least 100 of those are insects, with maybe as many as 25 being from land vertebrates out of the original 1 million fossils. Most of those are less than one bone, less than one intact bone. You say, well, I thought there were all kinds of dinosaur fossils. Well, there are some dinosaur fossils, and some complete skeletons or almost complete skeletons, but they're very, very rare. And they don't say much about the overall situation. You know, given that the land vertebrates live on land, and they are by far the most mobile of all creatures, in a situation where you have rising floodwaters, you would expect most of them to flee to higher ground and once caught in the water to fight the rising waters, and you would have far, far fewer of them trapped in the sediments forming on the seafloor. What would you expect most of the ones trapped in the sediment to be? They're going to be the sea creatures that live there on the seafloor. And that's exactly what the flood model would predict. These are the percentages the flood model predicts, and these percentages no evolutionary model can even explain, let alone predict. Don't fold your tent. An interesting fossil that's considered an anomaly is petrified wood. Among fossils, number 4, petrified wood, Mike has several samples of it down in his office. I should ask him to bring a couple pieces up, but don't have time to show them around. But petrified wood is an anomaly. It's interesting for a few reasons. Here's a diagram of Specimen Ridge, which is in Yellowstone National Park. It's easier to see this in a diagram than actual photos. I'll show you a couple of photos in a minute. But the ridge itself is covered by a modern forest, and so you can't see much of this. It's easier in this stripped away diagram. And you've got layers of stone in this ridge, and within this ridge you have a bunch of petrified trees on the edge and also buried within. And it's quite a fascinating thing to study. Unfortunately, for the evolutionary model, close examination has indicated that these petrified trees that are standing upright there are actually standing upright in growth position, but they're not in their growth location. None of them have root systems beneath them. They have a root ball, but all the roots are broken off. None of them have a root system supporting them. And notice that they're all broken off at more or less uniform lengths or heights. There is no such thing as an intact petrified tree. None has ever been discovered. They're all broken off like this. In fact, the sign that used to be there at Yellowstone explaining that these trees grew here and that this is evidence of many various forests being destroyed and then regrowing later on top of another layer of soil and so on, that's been taken down since they've discovered. They haven't put up a disclaimer ever, but they've at least taken down the sign that explains that, because they found that those trees are not actually standing in their growth position, in their growth location. Interestingly enough, something very similar happened at Mount St. Helens. Spirit Lake on the north shore of, on the north bank of, bank's the wrong word, north slope of Mount St. Helens, right after the eruption, was completely covered with debris, wooden debris from all the forest that was just destroyed by the eruption. And much of that sank to the bottom or was eventually drifted away. But as time went on, the trees that were floating on the surface of Spirit Lake began to orient themselves in more or less growth position, upright, as the root balls sank deeper into the water because they were heavier and more dense. And so they began to float in an upright position, like this, more or less. Many of them did. Some, not all did, but some did. And then, as this diagram shows, because they can't take pictures underwater, they don't have pictures from underwater that can show this, they began to sink to the bottom and stand on the bottom soils in the layers of soil just laid down by the eruption in growth position, but not in their growth location. It looks a lot like Specimen Ridge, at least like Specimen Ridge probably looked originally as the soils were hardening. So little letter A, in growth position, but not in growth location, as can also be seen in actual petrified wood deposits today. Now let's go back to Specimen Ridge. Here are a couple of photographs. In growth position, but not in their growth location. No root systems under these petrified trees. Here are a couple more. And again, they're more or less uniform in the length at which they're broken off. This speaks of catastrophic destruction and movement to a new location. Here's one bedded right on the edge of a cliff, a part of the stone there, but there's no root under it, as you can see. These are all from Specimen Ridge. Now, come back to that diagram. Another thing they'll tell you, I don't know if you've noticed this, but another aspect of the problem for that's such an anomaly for petrified wood is that many, many of these petrified trees are buried standing upright in multiple layers of sedimentary rock. They're called cross-strata fossils, which is impossible in an evolutionary model. That is, they are standing on a layer that they say are a certain number of millions of years old. They are buried under and surrounded by another layer that is not quite as old, but also counted in the millions of years. And then there's the trunk extends up beyond that, even into another layer. How in the world does a tree stand there while layers of stone are deposited around it over millions of years? That can't happen in any evolutionary model. But it's exactly what the flood predicts. And so, as I've got for little letter B, often standing cross strata, which is impossible in an evolutionary model. Also note that wood normally decays. It only petrifies in certain conditions. If you go out to your firewood pile and you unpack it all the way down to the ground, you're not going to find petrified wood at the bottom. What you're going to find is mush, okay? Because you're going to have termites or other burrowing insects that have gotten into it, and it's rotted away. That's what's going to happen to that which is in contact with the moist earth. So this doesn't happen under normal conditions. Wood normally rots away. It doesn't become petrified. However, it can become petrified if conditions are right. Even today, with shorter term petrification at work, all right? Now, it takes time. It doesn't happen quickly. The trees that were buried at Mount St. Helens have not yet petrified, although many believe they probably will if left alone. Many of them probably will petrify. But there have been wooden fence posts that were buried in a fence that was put up 150 years ago, wooden fence posts dug up where the bottom of the fence posts have petrified, if the conditions are right. And I didn't come in with the chemistry ready to go on what those conditions have to be. But it can happen today. And it can happen much shorter term than millions of years that the evolutionists assume it must have taken. Moving on, rock layers also show no evidence of time passing between them. There are very few uniformitarian geologists these days. They've given up on the idea that the rock layers just gradually accumulated over time and became a layer of rock. They show too much evidence of being turbidites, and they have been deposited rapidly. And so they're now talking about a catastrophic deposit of a particular layer and then a period of tranquility for time to pass and for evolution to occur, and then for another layer to be laid on top of that. But what happened to the time in those layers, between those? You would expect all sorts of what's called bioturbation, that is evidence of life, with soils and movement and carcasses and such there buried between those layers. But none of them have any evidence of any of that. There's no room for time to have occurred in between those. They show no evidence of time passing between them. So this is really problematic for the evolutionary model, because that time should have left some evidence behind. Here's a picture from the Grand Canyon. You've got two different shale or sandstone layers above and below, and that black streak in the middle is a coal seam. Now, a coal seam is generally presumed to be the metamorphose remains of a swamp peat deposit. But swamp peats are very active biological systems. All sorts of plant and animal bioturbation going on in a peat swamp. There are lots of highs and lows in a peat swamp. That coal deposit's almost uniform in its thickness and absolutely horizontal in the way it's laid down there between those two sandstone deposits. A sandstone or shale deposit is an ocean bottom deposit. How you got a peat swamp between two ocean bottom layers is also a mystery that an evolutionist can't explain. Other problems. Here's a layer that's been broken away or cut away and laid on its side, or laid standing on end. You see the ripples in that? You ever been to the beach and seen ripples in the sand? How long do they last? Till the next wave, right? For ripples to have been preserved like that, it had to have been buried again by another layer almost immediately before another wave could have come by to disturb the ripples. It would have eroded. Here's another example of ripples in stone buried between layers. Here's an example of dinosaur tracks in stone that hardened suddenly. Not just a track here and there, but here's a trail. You can't see it very well because of the light, but several steps as it's walking along the trail. And some of these layers have hardened and are in ways that it's impossible for an evolutionist to explain. Here's one from the Grand Canyon. This one's interesting to me. This red layer at the bottom has a name. It's called the Hermit Shale, capitalized. It's thought to be a deltaic underwater deposit, that is sediment built up from a huge river delta. The tan layer above it is called the Coconino Sandstone, also capitalized, and it's thought to be a desert sand dune deposit. Excuse me. Evolutionists say the deposits were separated in time by 10 million years. Look at that thin layer. 10 million years is supposed to have passed between them. The context between them is so flat, extremely extensive. By the way, this pairing of stone formations extends over a space exceeding 100,000 square miles. 100,000 square miles. This is a huge layering. And I don't know how you get a desert sand dune sitting directly on top of an underwater sedimentary deposit with absolutely no evidence of time having passed between them. But that's what the evolutionists have to assume, because that's what they claim these are. Moving to letter B, regional stratigraphy. That's all the catastrophic depositing of rock layers. That can only happen by a flood catastrophically depositing different kinds of stone or layers on top of one another. Now, it's important to note that these rock layers are not local phenomena, but the same layers are identifiable over extensive territories. Regional stratigraphy, that is, strata that extend over large regions. The Grand Canyon exposes in side view horizontally layered strata, as I've already mentioned. This is just another photo of the Grand Canyon, the rim in the far distance there, and you can see the river way down below there. At the lowest point in the Grand Canyon, when you get down to the lowest layer that's visible, you get down to a layer that's called the Tapetes Sandstone. And as far as you can see in within the Grand Canyon, the lowest layer is the Tapetes Sandstone. It's horizontally embedded. It lies flat. And the Grand Canyon's pretty big, but the Grand Canyon is found in the corner of Arizona, New Mexico, and Nevada. And it's only a tiny portion of the entire strata. The Tapetes Sandstone actually covers that much territory. The Grand Canyon is right there. Okay? This is the Tapetes Sandstone. It covers at least that much territory. It's been discovered that far, in that much extent so far. Almost all of North America. It's the lowest level of what is called the Salk sequence of rocks. And looking back at the Grand Canyon, that stack of sedimentary deposits on top of the Tapetes Sandstone are called the Salk sequence of rocks. And so the Salk sequence in number two, they are sedimentary layers that sit atop the Tapetes Sandstone. And this series of stones is hemispherical in extent. It's understood as being a series of underwater mudflows, turbidites, that were deposited at speeds of 90 miles an hour, covering most of the northern hemisphere. That's evidence of a huge flood that would be consistent with the Genesis account of Noah's flood. Now, if the flood were responsible for the rocks, we would expect that some of the rocks would be deposited and then deformed before they had a chance to completely harden, because the flood was a very turbulent event. Here is a place in the Tapetes Sandstone where it is not lying horizontally, but is standing almost vertically, almost straight up and down. Sediments deforming letter C, while soft. Sediments deforming while soft. The Tapetes Sandstone layer is deposited on top of a bedrock layer called the Vishnu Schist. Now, creationists believe the Vishnu Schist was part of the created earth. The base stone, the bedrock upon which the earth was built, was created. And that the other layers on top of that were all laid down by the flood. Now, during the flood, we are told that the fountains of the deep were broken up, and so a lot of stuff got shifted around. And what we have here is this, let me check my slides. Yeah, this is number 47, sorry. A cross-section of the Grand Canyon geology that shows how an uplift in the Vishnu Schist shoved everything that became the Grand Canyon up about a mile above where the layers exist at a distance of about 250 miles away from the Grand Canyon in the middle of Arizona. And this is called the Kaibab Upwarp. The Kaibab Upwarp. No relation to the old restaurant here in town. Okay. Now, above the Vishnu Schist, this brown layer right here, that's the Tapetes Sandstone. It's the lowest layer. Now, evolutionists say that the tapir sandstone here at the bottom is dated at 550 million years. The Kaibab limestone at the top is 250 million years old. And this upshift happened 70 million years ago. So by the time this upshift happened, the most recent layer of stone was 180 million years old. Now, you would expect stone that was that old, that had been sitting there hardening for that long, if you shift it up a mile, that this seam would be shattered and broken stone. That's what happens to rock when it shifts like that. It shatters and breaks. But that's not what you find. What you find instead is this. Look at that. That's the Tapir sandstone. See these two circles? Those are climbers, just to give you some scale. There's people climbing in that. That's the Tapir sandstone. In a space of about 100 feet, it goes from vertical to horizontal. And the layers are stretched and warped like clay or, I don't know, it reminds me of taffy. It had to have been soft when that happened. That's the point. And you find this everywhere. You find shattered stone nowhere along that upwork. The seam is bent and warped. It is not broken. That's number two under letter C. Number one, the Kaibab upwork lifted a vast plateau of multiple layers. And number two, the seam of the along where it lifted is bent and warped. It is not broken. Now, I'm skipping all the information that they included in the book on and the pictures they had of a phenomenon called clastic dikes, where a lower layer sandstone is injected upward through cracks in the above in the surfaces above when it was still soft. It's kind of like toothpaste, and those can be found in certain places too, while the sandstone was still pliable. I'm skipping all that, but if you're interested, you can get his book. All right. Now, the fourth facet of the answer to the geological challenge of the evolutionists is the rapid canyon formation. Look at that picture. How many of you really think that the Colorado River at the base of the Grand Canyon formed that ditch under current conditions? There's not enough water and not enough energy. That's the problem. Not enough water, not enough energy. The Colorado River would never form that kind of canyon. It required much more water and energy than is currently available. It took a whole lot more. And it needed to happen when everything was still soft, which is exactly what the flood predicts. As a result, it would happen much more rapidly than a uniformitarian could possibly assume, as it hollowed out that trench as a vast amount of water quickly ran off while the ground was still relatively soft. Not entirely soft, but relatively soft. Left the layers behind. Left the layers exposed behind. The final facet to the answer to the geological challenge is the inconsistent dating. Inconsistent dating. How do you date a rock? Sorry. How do you date a rock? Radioisotope dating is one form. And I'm not going to go into too much detail here, partly because I'm about to exhaust the extent of my knowledge anyway. In broad strokes, radioisotope dating is only possible in igneous rock. You can't do radioisotope dating on sedimentary rock. Sedimentary rock is a whole bunch of pieces from a lot of different sources glued together by some kind of a cementing material. That's what makes it sedimentary. Igneous is magma that's hardened. It's volcanic rock that is hardened. And radioisotope dating has no relevance to anything other than igneous rock. You can only date hardened volcanic lava. And it gives inconsistent results. Let me illustrate this. Come back to this diagram. You saw it a little earlier. Now here you've got two layers in black. These are the only two layers of igneous rock present at the Grand Canyon. You've got the Cardenas basalts lying under the Tapir sandstone, which is the lowest horizontal layer. All right, you've got the Cardenas basalts here, and you've got the basaltic rocks of the Uinkaret Plateau up here on top. According to radioisotope dating, this Cardenas basalt layer underneath the whole thing, the whole stack, the entire Salk sequence, that Cardenas basalt layer tests out and has been dated at 1.1 billion years of age. 1.1 billion years of age. Where they run into trouble is when they date this top layer, the basaltic rocks of the Uinkaret Plateau. That layer dates at 1.3 billion years, 200 million years older than the stone down here. And this top layer across which this runs is dated at 250 million years in age. Okay, they got problems with the model. Now, you might say, well, this is a volcanic stone, and so maybe it comes from deeper underground, and it's actually older stone that has come up. But that's not the way radioisotope dating works. Radioisotope clock starts when the rock hardens. If you melt it down to magma again, the clock resets. Samples of the magma rock, the igneous rock formed when Mount St. Helens erupted, were sent for testing. And we know when Mount St. Helens erupted. It was in 1980. In 2006, samples of that magma, of that igneous rock, were sent to a laboratory to test and to date with radioisotope dating. A blind test because they didn't know where this came from. That's the way they have to do that, so they won't shape their test results according to what they're presuming already. And so they were sent in as a blind test. The radioisotope dating of those stones came back and said that those stones were 2.4 million years old. All right, they missed, they were only 27 years old, okay? They missed it by a factor of 100,000. That's a pretty significant miss. They're badly insignificant. Radioisotope dating of igneous rock gives inconsistent results. And I'm convinced that God gave us the Mount St. Helens eruption to show us all this. Okay? So what do they do with sedimentary rocks then? How do they date sedimentary rocks? Well, sedimentary rocks are dated by the so-called index fossils that are found within the layers. They can tell you how old the rock is because they've assigned ages to the fossils that are found there. Well, how do they know how old the fossils are? Well, they can tell you how old the fossils are because of how old the rock layer is in which they're found. Yeah, exactly. That's circular reasoning, right? We know how old the rock layer is because these fossils are found there. We know these fossils are this old because we know how old the rock layer is. It proves nothing. But that's the method that they use for dating igneous rocks or sedimentary rocks. So dating with sedimentary rock uses circular reasoning. Now, we've all heard of carbon-14. And so doesn't carbon-14, also called radioactive carbon or radiocarbon, doesn't that prove billions of years of evolution? You know, stable carbon, normal carbon, the carbon that is in the graphite of your pencil or the diamond on your in your ring, that carbon is carbon-12. Carbon-14 is radioactive carbon, and it decays rather rapidly. In fact, this is a good evidence of a young Earth, not the old Earth model. You can't use carbon-14 to date rocks because rocks don't contain carbon, generally. Carbon is a biological compound or element found in biology. Carbon-14 decays to carbon-12 so quickly. Dr. Andrew Snelling, PhD in geology, said this. He used this as an extreme example. He says if the entire Earth were made up of nothing but, originally, all it was a big solid ball of carbon-14. Every molecule in the Earth was carbon-14. If that's what the Earth was at the time of its formation, all of it would have completely decayed to carbon-12 in less than a million years. You understand that the existence of carbon-14 today proves the Earth can't be a million years old because it decays too fast. It decays too fast, and there's no mechanism for creating new carbon-14, new radioactive carbon. And so it's not used to date fossils because it blows up their model. When fossils are tested with for carbon-14 and they're shown to contain carbon-14, and I'm going to deal with this a little more next week, evolutionists routinely ignore it. Dr. Snelling actually took coal samples from two different seams, one of them dated by evolutionists at 30 million years and another at 200 million years, submitted those to blind testing for analysis to test for carbon-14, and both of them came back showing carbon-14 that would have dated them in the thousands of years by their carbon-14 age. Far from proving the age of the Earth in billions of years, carbon-14 is deadly to the evolutionary model. Radiocarbon dating supports a young Earth, number three. So, to wrap this up, opposing interpretations of the same data, conclusion. Number four, opposing interpretations of the same data. The evolutionary model, looking at this diagram again, labeled for evolutionary ages. The evolutionary model assumes that the Earth is 4.5 to 6 billion years old, number one. That the Earth is 4.5 to 6 billion years old. And they're looking at these stones and dating them with that assumption. It's 4.5 to 6 billion years old. The Grand Canyon's foundation, and these are Grand Canyon rocks here, the Grand Canyon's foundation is about 2 billion years old. The overlying rock layers range from 550 million years old to 250 million years old. But they have a serious problem with an overlying layer on the surface dated at 1.3 billion years. It's pretty clear their model has some serious problems. On the other hand, here's the same diagram dated with the creation model's assumptions. At the base, you've got creation rock. God created the earth about 6,000 to 10,000 years ago. God flooded the earth about 4,500 years ago, and all these rock layers were laid down in a single year by the flood, during which all the rock layers were laid down and all the fossils were encased. And by the way, that would include fossil fuels like petroleum and coal, were laid down by the flood. Left this behind as evidence of what God had done with the flood. Mount St. Helens gives us a working laboratory to test some of the dating techniques. And I like Dr. John Morris's concluding slide. He says, it looks like time is running out on the theory of evolution. As I said, this was largely defensive. Next week, we'll go on offense, and we'll talk about the evidences for a young Earth instead of just defending ourselves from the attacks of those who claim the Earth has to be billions of years old. Now, maybe, you know, if you don't feel necessarily equipped to argue all this, at least you understand that you don't have to apologize for anything. The evolutionists have got it wrong. And we're talking about just opposing interpretations of the same data. It's all about what you believe happened. Now, I'll readily admit mine's based on faith that God gave us the right record, told us the truth in Scripture. The evolutionist is more reluctant to admit that they're basing their same faith in something that they can't prove. But it's still a matter of faith. Let's close by singing the first verse of How Great Thou Art. David, would you get the center light here for us? That's all we'll need, the first one. That is number 28, the first verse. Let's sing this together. Let's stand together and sing. I'll just direct it from right here.